most Americanized daughter as her interpreter. Not only was Mei's English excellent, like my interpreter Mei Ying Zhang, she had learned it in an American high school, so her grammar and vocabulary were superior to those of almost any Hmong adult. But after Janine left, Fo and Nakao were able to ask Mei as often as necessary, "Explain what Jenny said again?" Janine's empathy for the Lees may have been deepened by two factors. She understood what it was like to live with a chronic illness because she had severe asthma herself, and she admired the closeness of Hmong families because her relations with her own family, who were fundamentalist Christians, had been strained for many years ever since they had learned that she lived with a lesbian partner. She had no children of her own. Unlike the MCMC nurses who considered Leah a burden and a pest, Janine thought she was a delightful child. "I just totally fell in love with her," Janine recalled. "Leah wasn't your average typical kid that would play inappropriate with toys and, you know, do all the right things. She was like a little blowfly, flitting about just totally out of control and wild and unsocialized, but, well, absolutely adorable. Physically, I found her a very attractive child. She was real cute and real huggable. I mean, this kid could give you a hug like no other kid could. She would climb into your arms and sit in your lap and just give you a terrific bear hug and grab your glasses and pinch your cheeks until they hurt." Janine's involvement in Leah's case rapidly escalated from a professional assignment to an obsession. A typical Hilt letter, written with cheerful officiousness, to Judy Epley, a counselor at a regional agency for the developmentally disabled. Re, Leah Lee. "Dear Judy, please forward to me copies of all psychologicals, neurologicals, assessments, evaluations, reports, workups, impressions, studies, reviews, ruminations, appraisals, opinions, etc., on the above-named minor. I hope that covers it. Thanks for your help. Sincerely, Janine Hilt, social worker." In Neil's opinion, Janine was a large pain in the ass. He remembered innumerable times when she had nagged him for information about Leah for prescriptions for medical equipment he considered unnecessary, such as an electronic digital thermometer that she had hoped to teach Fo to use, with May's help in reading the numbers. Whatever she requested was always needed immediately and at no cost to the Lees. "Janine took on the Lees like a crusade," said Neil. "She always wanted to be notified about any change in Leah's condition, and my God, it wasn't like we didn't have 6 billion other things that we had to think of. If you forgot to call her, she'd read you the riot act. I think she had trouble understanding that Leah was just one of hundreds or thousands of patients that we took care of, and we couldn't drop everything and do exactly what she wanted. But it was a double-edged sword. She was good, too. Janine was an incredible patient advocate. There was nothing she wouldn't do for this kid." One of the things Janine arranged was to have Leah bused 3 days a week to the Shelby Center for Special Education, the county school for retarded and disabled children. She hoped the Shelby would help socialize Leah as well as giving Fo an occasional respite. Leah's teacher, Sunny Lippert, recalled, "Leah was very spoiled. Janine Hilt told us the family felt that she talked to the gods during her seizures and that they had this euphoric idea that she was a princess. They fixed her special things to eat, and whatever she wanted, they did. If she raised her arms, her mother would carry her through the house. She got rather chubby, and the more she sat around and let people do things for her, the heavier she got. She was a beautiful child. Her mother just groomed her until she was immaculate. Leah could charm the hair right off a dog. She was the type you just want to pick up, but I had a rule in my room. No one could pick up Leah. Of course, as soon as she went home, her family kept right on catering to her." Believing that Leah's behavioral problems stemmed partly from a lack of daily structure, Janine posted the following on the Lees' wall. "Leah's schedule. 7. Wake up. breakfast, bath. 8. Meds, leave for school. 1. Home from school. 2. Meds, nap. 4. Playtime. 6. Dinner. 7. Bath, pajamas. 8. Meds, bed. Despite May's help in reading it, this schedule never fully took hold, partly because of Fo and Nikau's orientation to the cock-crow system rather than to the clock. Another fruitless effort was a list of instructions about how to administer Tylenol and Valium to prevent febrile seizures when Leah spiked a temperature. Janine went to great trouble to have it translated into swirly Lao script, failing to realize that no one in the Lee family spoke or read Lao. But in her most important goal, persuading the Lees to administer Leah's medication, Janine achieved a stunning success. Blood tests showed that Leah was regularly maintaining a therapeutic level of Depakine. During her first 4 months at home, she had only one seizure, her best record since infancy. Janine attributed this period of unusual health to the Depakine. The Lees attributed it to the successful intervention of the Xining in Minnesota. In September of 1986, Leah fell off a swing at the Shelby Center, hit her head, and went into status epilepticus, the condition dreaded by all her doctors, in which her seizures, instead of spontaneously resolving after a few minutes, continued one after another with no intervals of consciousness. It was unclear whether Leah fell because she seized or whether she seized because she fell, but in any case, when she was taken to the hospital, she was found to have adequate levels of Depakine in her bloodstream. Parental noncompliance, for once, was manifestly not a factor. Nakao's diagnosis was that the teacher made her drop from the swing, and when she fell she was scared and her soul went away too, so she got sick again. In Leah's MCMC admission summary, her medical history was noted to be complicated, and her social history to be very complicated. Neil remembers the admission, Leah's 14th stay at MCMC, to be the most harrowing she had ever had.
She'd been doing real well. Real, real well. And then came this unbelievable set of problems. She had a bad seizure, and all this food crap started coming out of her mouth, and she aspirated a lot of it into her lungs. She went into respiratory failure. She couldn't breathe for herself, so we had to intubate her. Then the breathing tube caused more local irritation of the trachea. So after we pulled it out, she started breathing with a lot of difficulty, and we had to re-intubate her. And then she got this very unusual infection of the airway from the irritation. The parents had to go along with a lot of stuff. An oxygen mask, lots of IVs, blood work, an arterial line to measure the oxygen and carbon dioxide in her blood. Real invasive stuff. Nikau remembered this as the time when Leah had a lot of plastic all over her. He or Fo slept by Leah's side every one of the 14 nights she spent in the hospital. He recalled, "The doctors made Leah stay so long in the hospital, it just made her sicker and sicker." Neil and Peggy co-authored an article in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal called Bacterial Tracheitis Caused by Brainhamella catarrhalis, about Leah's tracheal infection. "Leah got published," is how Neil put it when he showed me the article several years later. In it, they wrote, "Our case clearly demonstrates that this agent, B. catarrhalis, has the potential for being an opportunistic infection in the compromised respiratory tract of a pediatric patient. Our patient's hospital-acquired infection was most probably the result of a local injury to the trachea from a cuffed endotracheal tube and from alteration of oral bacterial flora with intravenously administered penicillin." Not every doctor would choose to publicize a nosocomial or hospital-acquired infection, especially if, as was the case here, It was he rather than an inexperienced resident who had been responsible for inflicting the local injury. When I read the article, I was struck, as I had often been before, by how much more interested Neil and Peggy were in the truth than in making themselves look good. I was also struck by the fact that Nakao was absolutely right. The hospital had made Leah sicker. Only 3 weeks after Leah was discharged, she was admitted again, despite adequate levels of medication, with severe seizures and fever. Neil and Peggy were horrified.
"I had been really impressed that she was having such good control with the Depakine," recalled Neil. "And then she had two seizures within a month, and I said, 'Oh God, here we go again. The Depakine is not working.' I couldn't think of any good way to keep her seizures from getting worse. I remember we thought about putting her under anesthesia to stop her shaking the next time she came in, so we could at least get an IV in. And I remember Dan Murphy and I had a few conversations about whether we should try surgery to try to cauterize part of Leah's brain. But I really didn't know what to do. I was just grabbing at straws."
Peggy said, "The seizures were getting very, very long. Before, sometimes they used to stop on their own, but these didn't. It seemed like it took more medication to stop them, and we were afraid that one day we were going to try to get in an IV and just not be able to do it, because Leah was so fat, and because we'd already cut down so many of her veins. If she seized long enough, she was going to gork her brain out. Early that fall, we started to get this feeling of doom. We talked about it a lot. It was hard to imagine that the Leah era would ever be over, but I remember thinking it was going to be. We were just waiting for the big one."
Neil said, "I felt like there was this giant snowball that was coming down the mountain and we were trying to hold it up there, and it just kept pushing us. I remember talking to the parents and telling them that Leah's seizures were getting worse and more frequent, and that someday she might have one we couldn't stop. It was so haunting. I started to have nightmares that it was going to happen. I would be the one on call and I couldn't stop it, and she was going to die right before my eyes. It was inevitable. It was just a matter of when."
Chapter 10. War. A folktale collected in 1924 by François-Marie Savina, the French missionary, reports that when the Hmong lived in the primordial northern homeland, where the days and nights were 6 months long, they were once involved in a land dispute with some neighboring tribes. Their king resolved it as follows. Each tribe would select an envoy who would walk as far as he could during the 6 months between sunset to sunrise, returning to the king's golden palace at the end of his journey. All the territory that he covered would belong to his tribe. If one of the envoys failed to reach the palace, his tribe would be commanded to live wherever he stood at the moment the sun rose. At daybreak, the Hmong envoy was standing on a high pinnacle, and this is why, ever since then, the Hmong have always lived in the mountains, where they are the first to see the sun rise and the last to see it set. If that footsore walker had ended up standing on the plains instead, the fate of the Hmong would have been entirely different. Almost every aspect of the tribe's history and character proceeds from the essential fact that they are Montagnards. As the Hmong proverb puts it, "Fish swim in the water, birds fly in the air. The Hmong live in the mountains." The Hmong language has dozens of terms for mountains of different shapes, different slopes, different elevations. "Ask a Miao, Hmong, the name of his country of origin," wrote Savina, "and he will answer with the name of a mountain. Such and such is the mountain where I was born," he will say. "Ask him where that mountain happened to be, and he will indicate whether it was to the north, the south, the east, or the west, instead of telling you where it was in China, in Tonkin, or in Laos." When a Hmong was obliged to descend to the lowlands,
Savina observed, he could easily be identified by his peculiar gait. Accustomed to frequenting steep, rocky paths, he would forget that he was walking on smooth, flat road, and he would raise his foot too high with each step, as if he were climbing a staircase or feared he were going to trip. On the plain, a meow was as much out of his element as a sailor on dry land. In pre-war Laos, the various ethnic groups were stratified as post-cafe. The Lao lived in the plains. The Karen and the Kamu lived above the altitude of 50 meters. The Mien lived above 400 meters. And finally, wrote Father Jean Moton, at the highest altitudes for the people of these regions, between 1,000 and 2,000 meters, if it is possible, live the Hmong. Seek among the highest and most inaccessible mountains, and there you will find them, for it is there they find themselves at home. The lowland Lao may have been richer, more numerous, and politically more powerful, but the Hmong, peering down at their putative masters like eagles looking at mice, always managed to maintain an unbudgeable sense of superiority. As it had in China, their ethnic identity remained pure. Assimilation was easy to resist because their contacts with the dominant culture were so few. They rarely visited the plains, which they called the land of leeches, believing, with some justification, given the greater incidence of tropical diseases at low elevations, that doing so would make them sick. No one passed through their territory en route to anywhere else. And although they were occasionally visited by the Yunnanese traders bringing silver, cloth, thread, shoes, and cooking pots, they were able to keep trade to a minimum because they were so self-sufficient. They produced all their own food, as well as all the fodder for their livestock, using homemade flintlock rifles or crossbows made of wood, bamboo, and hemp. They hunted birds, rats, monkeys, gibbons, deer, wild pigs, and tigers. They fished the mountain streams. They gathered fruits, greens, wild mushrooms, tubers, and bamboo shoots. They picked slow-moving grasshoppers from the undersides of leaves in the early morning cold and roasted them. They tied chicken feathers around the thoraxes of bees, followed them back to their hives, smoked out the bees, removed the honey, picked up the bee larvae, and steamed them. When they got thirsty in the forest, they plucked large upturned leaves shaped like dishes and drank the dew. In the Hmong language, there are hundreds of lyrical two-word expressions, not the stuff of poetry, but of everyday speech, that onomatopoeically describe various sounds. These alliterative expressions, collected by the linguist Martha Ratliff, give some inkling of the intimate relationship the Hmong of Laos had with the natural world. Some samples: Zhujie, a cicada singing; Li Long, bees buzzing; Blu Pong, a boar grunting; Mi Ma, tigers playing; E A, wild pigs fighting in close combat; Zi Zhe, a rat or mouse crying out in a snake's mouth; Su Su, a snake undulating; Zi Zhe, birds chirping; Tun Tuo, birds shuffling through leaves looking for insects; Bli Bla, a bird rising from its nest on the ground; Ji Zhu, monkeys swishing through the treetops with a continuous noise; Ji Zhu, monkeys leaping through the treetops with separate noises; Du Deng, a tree popping fast before it falls; Chun Tao, a tree popping slowly before it falls; Viva, a tree brushing through other trees and underbrush while it falls; Ngaku, many trees falling one right after another;
Pipa.
Fruit falling on the ground.
Bliblong.
Fruit falling in water.
Susuo.
A long, easy, all-day rain. Like most people who live close to the land, the Hmong were farmers. Fu Ying once told me that everyone in her village did the same work, so no one was more important than anyone else. There was no class system. Since no one knew how to read, no one felt deprived or inconvenienced by the lack of literacy. Everything the next generation needed to know was passed on orally and by example. How to venerate the ancestors. How to play the qing. How to conduct a funeral. How to court a lover. How to track a deer. How to build a house. How to embroider a skirt. How to butcher a pig. How to flail a load of rice. Although they harvested enough rice, corn, and vegetables for their own needs, the only crop the Hmong could indisputably grow better than the lowland Lao, because it was specifically suited to the cool temperatures and alkaline soils of the highlands, was the opium poppy. There is, of course, a legend about it. Once, long ago, there was a wanton Hmong beauty whose libertinage led her to her early death. From her grave grew a flower. Its pod exuded a sap whose fragrance enabled anyone who inhaled it to re-experience the ecstasy her lovers had once enjoyed. Through the medium of dreams, she initiated her posthumous acolytes into the mysteries of opium cultivation and preparation. The dreams must have been highly instructive, for ever since the end of the 18th century, when the British East India Company introduced the opium poppy to China, the Hmong have been master opium growers, drawn willy-nilly into an international trade they neither created nor controlled. In Laos, the French colonial government encouraged them to pay their taxes in raw opium in order to supply the official lowland network of government-licensed opium dens. The Hmong complied with ease. They knew how to choose the best soil for growing opium by tasting it for its lime content. They knew how to broadcast the poppy seeds in cornfields so the young plants would be protected by the corn stalks. They knew how to incise the pods with triple-bladed knives, cutting neither so deep that the sap dripped to the ground nor so lightly that it was trapped inside the pods. Wait until the extruded sap coagulated and turned brown. Scrape it, wrap it in poppy petals or banana leaves, knead it, and form it into bricks. My Hmong dictionary lists 29 terms related to opium cultivation and smoking, from Dia Yang, the knife used to score the pods, to Yang Cheng, the needle-like tool used to hold the wad of opium while preparing it for smoking. Surprisingly few Hmong, aside from the chronically ill and the elderly, were addicts. Opium was reserved mainly to facilitate the ceremonial trances of Zinengs, to dull the pain of headaches, toothaches, snake bites, and fever, to staunch diarrhea, and to ease the discomforts of old age. Young addicts, most of whom were men, shouldered a heavy burden of shame. Stigmatized by their diminished ability to work, they not only had trouble finding brides themselves, but blackened the marital prospects of their brothers and cousins. The Hmong kept less than 10% of their opium yield for their own use and sold the rest. It was their only cash crop. One could hardly invent a more perfect commodity for mountain transport. Easily portable, immune to spoilage, and possessing a stratospherically high value-to-weight ratio. 1 kilogram of opium was worth as much as half a ton of rice. The saddlebags of a single modest caravan of ponies led by a lowland merchant could carry a village's entire annual output of crude opium bricks. The Hmong accepted no paper currency for their opium, only silver bars or piastres which they melted down to make jewelry or hoarded for bride prices. Opium production equaled wealth.
No wonder that when Christian missionaries first came to Laos, they often found small, meticulously wrapped balls of opium in their offering plates. No wonder that the parents of my interpreter believed that Mei Ying, opium poppy, was the most beautiful name they could give their daughter. The Hmong grew their opium as they grew their rice and corn as a slash-and-burn crop. The more polite agricultural term is swidden. In the dry season, the women cut away the forest underbrush with knives, and the men felled the trees with axes. Then the men sprinted down the hillsides, igniting the piles of vegetation with torches. The flames often rose 400 feet in the air, and swirling smoke could be seen for miles. When the charred brush had cooled enough to touch, entire families worked together to clear the debris before they planted, leaving only boulders and tree stumps. Swidden farming required no plowing, no irrigation, no terracing, no fertilizing. The topsoil was briefly enriched by wood ashes, but 4 or 5 years of monsoons washed it away, and the remaining soil was so exhausted that 20 years could pass before it was once again productive. In the 1950s, it was estimated that the Hmong of Laos were burning about 400 square miles of land a year, and by letting the topsoil leach away, causing enough erosion to alter the course of rivers. Opium was a particularly egregious offender, since instead of eventually reforesting like rice swiddens, old opium swiddens became covered in a coarse grass called imparata, which even animals refused to eat. The practice of swidden farming is inextricably intertwined with the migrant identity of the Hmong. The residents of a village would farm the contiguous land, abandon it in a few years when the soil became depleted, farm the land within walking distance, abandon that, build overnight shelters in order to farm even more distant land, and then, finally, move the entire village. Like Elizabeth I of England, who scheduled her progresses from castle to castle in the pre-plumbing era by departing whenever the smell became unbearable, the Hmong moved when a village's accumulation of garbage and animal feces grew unpleasant or began to make people sick. If a village got overcrowded, extended family groups sometimes established satellite villages nearby. Hmong houses, split bamboo or wooden planks lashed together with ropes and sinews, were designed to be easily dismantled, portaged, and reassembled. Hmong arts were portable too. No monumental sculpture, highly evolved textiles, jewelry, music, and storytelling. Because they always moved in groups rather than as individuals, their clan structure, their religion, and their cultural identity accompanied them wherever they went, constituting an essential sense of home that inoculated them against perpetual homesickness. The life of the swidden migrant bespoke a certain prodigal faith in the earth's inexhaustible abundance, the confidence that if one field lost its fertility, one village its health, or one region its plenty, no matter. As the Hmong proverb declared, there's always another mountain. It was not a lazy attitude. Moving is difficult. When the Hmong left China for Indochina, they had committed themselves to a migration as a problem-solving strategy on the most arduous scale they could imagine. And in the 1960s and 1970s, when Laos became a battleground for the Vietnam War, they found themselves repeating the process yet again, even more drastically. First, within the nation's borders, and eventually far beyond them. In 1961, King Savanvatana of Laos, a well-meaning but sinewless intellectual who traced his lineage to the 8th century, quoted Proust, and drove an Edsel lamented, "Our country is the most peaceful in the world. At no time has there ever arisen in the minds of the Lao people the idea of coveting another's wealth, of quarreling with their neighbors, much less fighting them.
And yet, during the past 20 years, our country has known neither peace nor security. Enemies of all sorts have tried to cross our frontiers, to destroy our people, and to destroy our religion and our nation's aura of peace and concord. Foreign countries do not care either about our interests or peace. They are concerned only with their own interests. The Geneva Accords of 1954, signed after the French lost the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, had recognized 3 independent states in what had formerly been French Indochina: Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, which was temporarily partitioned into northern and southern zones that were supposed to be reunited within 2 years. Laos was to be neutral, but this economically piddling backwater, which in 1960 had 1 stoplight in its capital and only $3 million of exports, not counting opium, was cursed by its strategic location. Within Thailand and Burma to the west, Vietnam was to the east, and Cambodia to the south, all of them stronger and more populous, and none of them walled off by natural barriers, Laos was unlikely to stay neutral for long. Aided by the Viet Minh, Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnamese military forces, the communist Pathet Lao became entangled in a protracted struggle with the anti-communist Royal Lao government for control of the country. At this point in the United States, which had provided covert training to the Royal Lao Army since 1955, stepped up its involvement. "It may seem incredible in retrospect," wrote Clark Clifford, advisor to Presidents Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, and Carter in his memoirs, "but President Eisenhower considered the fate of that tiny landlocked Southeast Asian kingdom the most important problem facing the U.S. In 1961, on his last day in office, Eisenhower told President-elect Kennedy that if Laos were to fall to communism, it would be only a matter of time before South Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and Burma fell too. Kennedy agreed. There was only one problem. At the Geneva Conference of 1961 to 1962, the United States, the Soviet Union, North and South Vietnam, and 10 other nations agreed to a new set of accords in which they reaffirmed the neutrality of Laos and promised not to send in any foreign troops or military personnel. This is where the Hmong entered the picture. The United States was anxious to support an anti-communist government in Laos and to cut the military supply line that the North Vietnamese ran to South Vietnam along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a complex of roads and pathways in southeastern Laos near the Vietnam border. But how could it intervene while maintaining at least the appearance of legitimacy? Without violating the accords, American troops might be able to go to Vietnam, but not to Laos. The answer was to fight a war by proxy. Kennedy cut the Gordian knot by dispatching a cadre of CIA advisors, not foreign troops themselves, though in retrospect it is clear that they were military personnel who recruited, trained, and armed a secret guerrilla army of Hmong soldiers. Subsequently, supported by the Johnson and Nixon administrations, the Hmong Akhmer clandestine eventually came to number more than 30,000. Its soldiers fought the ground war, flew combat missions, directed airstrikes by Air America pilots, rescued downed American flyers, were dropped by helicopter and parachute to fight behind enemy lines, gathered intelligence on the movements of Pathet Lao and North Vietnamese troops, sabotaged roads and bridges, planted electronic transmitters in enemy units to pinpoint their locations for bombing raids, and intercepted materiel on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. At its peak, the Akhmer clandestine was the biggest CIA operation in the world,
but until 1987, when a British investigative journalist named Christopher Robbins published a book called The Ravens, The Men Who Flew in America's Secret War in Laos, the American public had heard little about it except rumors and denials. A typical sample from the New York Times, July 4, 1962. A Defense Department spokesman labeled as untrue today charges that United States planes were dropping arms to Mio, Hmong tribesmen in Laos. In 1965, Johnson commented sanctimoniously that the problem of Laos is the refusal of the communist forces to honor the Geneva Accords. What he failed to mention was that his own country wasn't honoring them either. It was just doing a better job of keeping its violations secret. According to Robbins, the war was so classified that American Air Force pilots in Vietnam who were recruited to fly planes for Air America, the CIA's proprietary airline in Laos, didn't even know until they arrived in Laos what country they'd volunteer to fight in. It was simply called the Other Theater. At first glance, it seems crazy that the CIA recruited the most remote ethnic minority in Laos, one notorious for its lack of national consciousness, instead of the dominant lowland Lao. The explanation lay both in the shortcomings of the Lao and in the special assets of the Hmong. A Royal Lao Army existed, but its soldiers had never been noted for their bellicosity. A Life magazine article of the period observed, "The Lao are among the most charming people in Asia, and the most otherworldly and least martial as well. Consequently, Lao troops have sometimes fired over the heads of the enemy rather than hurt anybody, much to the despair of American advisors." It was said that Lao soldiers were likely to lay down their weapons the first time they were attacked or sell them on the black market. The Hmong, on the other hand, to whom the CIA, like the Lao, referred as Mio, had a 4,000-year-long reputation as scrappy fighters. In Laos, they had already proven their mettle as guerrillas during the Second World War when they fought on the side of the Lao and the French during the Japanese occupation. And after the war, when similarly allied, they resisted the Viet Minh. The CIA thus conveniently inherited a counterinsurgent network of Hmong guerrillas that the French had organized in northern Laos 2 decades earlier. Reading American press accounts of the war from the early 60s through the early 70s, I was bemused by their simultaneous condescension toward and admiration for the Hmong, who were portrayed as noble savages with thrilling, ferocious temperaments. Like many primitive peoples, their word for enemy and stranger is the same, and they are as likely to skewer a visitor on the arrow of a crossbow as to welcome him. Mio tribesmen are tough little primitives skilled in the savage techniques of ambush and night assault. Sketchy reports trickle down from the hills and tell of heavy damage wreaked on communist motorcades by Mio tribesmen on the pro-government warpath. The Mios have never hesitated to kill. Not only are they ready and able to use weapons, but they also climb up and down the mountains with the agility of mountain goats, setting ambushes, destroying convoys, spreading terror in the enemy's rear and then fading back into the mountains. Many Hmong had reasons of their own for defending the Royal Lao government and thus for collaborating with the United States. Perhaps a fifth of them, mostly members and supporters of the Lo clan, which had a long-standing feud with the anti-communist Li clan, sided with the Pathet Lao. But the great majority, including those contacted by the CIA, supported the royalist camp, not because communism was ideologically less attractive than capitalism, but because it was more apt to threaten their autonomy. It was unlikely that communist agrarian land reformers would look with favor on Hmong Sweden culture. Moreover, because most Hmong had sided with the French before the collapse of colonial Indochina, They feared reprisals from the North Vietnamese who had recently inflamed old antagonisms by confiscating Hmong opium crops to trade for weapons. There were also persuasive social reasons for fighting on the royalist side. Traditionally snubbed by the lowland Lao, the Hmong were likely to gain status if they became the heroes of a military victory. Finally, many Hmong had a huge personal stake in the war because they lived in the mountains surrounding its most crucial theater of operation, the Plain of Jars, a plateau in northeastern Laos through which communist troops from the north would have to march in attempt to occupy the administrative capital of Vientiane on the Thai border. That the Hmong knew this strategic region like the back of their hands was not lost on the American military leaders who recruited them. Other hill tribes also supported the royalists, but the Hmong did most of the fighting. In 1971, while testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, an Undersecretary of State named U. Alexis Johnson said, "I personally feel that although the way the operation in Laos has been run is unorthodox, unprecedented, in many ways, I think it is something of which we can be proud as Americans. It has involved virtually no American casualties. What we are getting for our money is, to use the old phrase, very cost-effective." What Johnson was saying, in effect, was that Hmong lives came cheap. The annual cost of financing the Armée clandestine via the CIA, the Department of Defense, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, was about $500 million. The annual cost of the Vietnam War was about $20 billion. One of the reasons for this disparity was that in 1971, Army privates in Vietnam were paid between $197.50 and $339 a month. Hmong soldiers in Laos were paid an average of 2,000 kip, $3 a month. American soldiers in Vietnam ate army field rations, spaghetti, turkey loaf, ham and eggs, frankfurters, and beans, with periodic supplements of steak, ice cream, and beer. Hmong soldiers in Laos ate rice. American pilots were sent home after a year, or, if they flew over North Vietnam, after their 100th mission. The most famous Hmong pilot, Lieutenant Lee Lu, flew more than 5,000 missions before he was shot down. "There was no tour to complete," wrote Christopher Robbins. "No rest and recreation in Hong Kong or Australia. No end in sight to the war. Fly till you die," the MEO pilot said. Hmong soldiers died at a rate about 10 times as high as that of American soldiers in Vietnam. To call the Hmong American-paid mercenaries, as often been done, is to forget that mercenaries, whether lured by money or adventure, choose their profession. Not all Hmong became soldiers because of their own accord. Some were forced into combat because bombing in northern Laos had obliged them to abandon their fields, and there was no other employment. Some were coerced. General Vang Pao, the CIA-supported Hmong leader of the Armée clandestine, was said to punish villages that had failed to fill their soldier quotas by cutting off their food supplies or even sending his own troops to attack them. Jonas Vang-A, a Hmong leader in Merced, told me soon after I met him, "Vang Pao recruited by force. I was very lucky. My father had money, and he paid four other men to serve instead of my three brothers and me. Father sent us to school secretly, and those four men fight." Jonas left it at that. It was only when I knew him better several months later that I ventured to ask him what happened to the soldiers who had served in their stead. "All four die," he said, and after a moment of uncomfortable silence, changed the subject. Vang Pao was both the cornerstone of the war and its most cryptic figure. A natural leader who had begun his military career at 13 as an interpreter and jungle runner for the French, he rose precipitously through the ranks of the Royal Lao Army until, in the early 1950s, he was recommended for officer training school. When the captain overseeing the entrance exam noticed that this promising candidate knew almost no written French, he neatly resolved the problem by dictating the answers. Years later, Vang Pao expressed no embarrassment at having cheated. He emphasized, however, that the captain had merely told him the answers and not, as the story sometimes went, actually guided his hand.
"Whorehouse of shit," he told a Hmong interviewer. "I know how to write."
It is worth noting that this incident, far from tarnishing Vang Pao's reputation, as, for example, Ted Kennedy's fudged Spanish exam at Harvard tarnished his, merely added to his mythology. This was the sort of man who could never be held back by such petty impediments as rules. By 1961, when the CIA tapped him to lead their guerrilla army, Vang Pao was already a colonel, the highest rank a Hmong had ever attained, who had sealed his influence over the Hmong by choosing wives from three major clans. By 1963, he was a major general. He considered himself a modern reformer who supported education, criticized slash-and-burn farming, and urged the Hmong to assimilate into Lao society. Yet he once engaged a famous Zining to sacrifice two steers in order to coax an influential Hmong neutralist over to the rightist side, and postponed at least one bombing sortie because the leg bones of the chicken he ate for dinner were inauspiciously positioned. He tortured North Vietnamese prisoners with electric shocks and strafed Hmong villages that collaborated with the Pathet Lao. Yet, he served as a godfather and surrogate provider to hundreds of war widows and orphans. Even his enemies conceded his courage. He often accompanied his soldiers to the front lines, surviving several crash landings as well as bullet wounds in his arm and side. The CIA considered Vang Pao, according to the narration of a propaganda film of the time, a charismatic, passionate, and committed man, a patriot without a country. He was twice flown to the United States, invited to the White House, and, as the New York Times noted, during a 1969 visit to Disneyland, was given a Zorro suit as a jest that he wore recently, according to sources close to him, when he toured the Plain de Jarre, the vital area his forces recently captured. Realizing that the best way to guarantee Hmong collaboration was to support their opium trade, the CIA used its Air America aircraft to pick up crude opium bricks in remote villages and gave Vang Pao his own airline, Xiang Kuang Air Transport, nicknamed Air Opium, which flew opium from the secret Hmong military base at Long Tien in northern Laos to markets in Vientiane. After it was refined, much of the Hmong opium crop ended up in South Vietnam, where it helped addict an estimated 30,000 American soldiers to heroin. A large portion indirectly subsidized the Ach Mê clandestine, which is one reason the war was such a bargain. "I knew nothing of this," former CIA Director Richard Helms told a reporter for Frontline, who obviously didn't believe him in 1988. "It certainly was not policy." Some of Vang Pao's recruits were sent to training camps in Thailand. Others massed in Long Tien, an abandoned opium field surrounded on three sides by a protective barrier of limestone mountains, which, during the war, became the largest Hmong settlement in the world. New recruits drilled on the landing strip built by the CIA to accommodate cargo planes. Using cardboard targets their wives had cut from surplus butter boxes, they practiced their marksmanship with American M1 rifles and M2 carbines, as well as with captured Soviet submachine guns. They also learned how to handle mortars and surplus Air Force rockets, which they fired from homemade launchers. Since they could not read, trail watchers assigned to spot North Vietnamese convoys were provided with radio transmitters whose buttons were labeled with pictures of trucks and tanks. Their CIA advisors marveled at how quickly the Hmong, accustomed to crossbows and flintlocks, mastered the technology of warfare.
"You give one of these little guys an M1 rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition in the morning," said an American trainer in 1961. "And when he comes back that night, he'll be able to kill a man at 200 yards.
Christopher Robbins reported the story, perhaps apocryphal, perhaps not, that in the early days of the war, Hmong villagers peered under the fuselages of airplanes to determine whether they were male or female. A few years later, some of those villagers were crewing or piloting propeller-driven T-28 training planes converted to bombers. The Hmong also impressed the Americans with their adaptability. With little available timber, soldiers who had transplanted their families to Long Tien built houses out of empty rice sacks, knocked down ammunition crates, and flattened 55-gallon oil drums. They used grenades to fish and stuffed them inside chickens as bait for tigers. They used parachute cord to rope water buffaloes. In the United States, the conflict in Laos was called the Quiet War, as opposed to the noisy one in Vietnam, whose escalation had turned the Laotian Civil War into an international free-for-all, with the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China throwing their weight behind the path at Laos, while the United States continued to back the Royal Lao. But for the Hmong, the war was anything but quiet. More than 2 million tons of bombs were dropped on Laos, mostly by American planes attacking communist troops in Hmong areas. There was an average of one bombing sortie every 8 minutes for 9 years. Between 1968 and 1972, the tonnage of bombs dropped on the Plain of Jars alone exceeded the tonnage dropped by American planes in both Europe and the Pacific during World War II. In 1971, an American reporter named T.D. Allman flew over the Plain of Jars and reported that he had counted several hundred bomb craters on a single 100-foot hill, that most of the plain's vegetation had been stripped by American defoliants, and that napalm fires burned day and night. The Plain of Jars is still pocked with craters and littered with unexploded American-made cluster bombs ready to detonate at the accidental prodding of a hoe or the curious poke of a child. During the latter years of the war, as Hmong casualties mounted, younger and younger soldiers were recruited to fight the constant stream of well-trained North Vietnamese who were rotated annually. In Tragic Mountains, the Hmong, the Americans, and the Secret Wars for Laos, 1942 to 1992, Jane Hamilton Merritt quoted a former soldier named Vang Su, who volunteered in 1968 when he was 13. "Everyone knew that Vang Pao had been a soldier at 13. So many young boys volunteered to fight to protect our land. I was a small, weak boy, but determined to help my people. In my first fight, I discovered that I couldn't shoot my weapon by hand-holding it. It was too heavy. I had to find a rock or a tree to steady it on before firing. That was dangerous. So I asked Vang Pao if I could be a paratrooper. He agreed, and I trained for that. On my first jump, I was so light that I floated and floated and came down far from my unit. To solve my floating problem, the next time I jumped with a B-40 grenade launcher. That brought me down. But once on the ground, I wasn't strong enough to operate the B-40 effectively. I asked Vang Pao if I could be trained in intelligence. He agreed. That was the right place for me." In 1968, Edgar Pop Buell, a retired Indiana farmer who directed the U.S. Agency for International Development Relief Program in northern Laos, told Robert Chaplin of The New Yorker, "A few days ago, I was with Vang Pao's officers when they rounded up 300 fresh Hmong recruits. 30% of the kids were 14 years old or less, and about a dozen were only 10 years old. Another 30% were 15 or 16. The rest were 35 or over. Where were the ones in between? I'll tell you. They're all dead." In 1960, between 300,000 and 400,000 Hmong lived in Laos. There is a wide disagreement over what fraction died during the war and its aftermath, with estimates ranging from a tenth, in a 1975 Washington Post report, to half, in a 1970 report to the Senate Judiciary Committee on Refugees and Escapees. Some were soldiers who died in battle. Most were civilians killed by cannon and mortar fire, bombs, landmines, grenades, post-war massacres, hunger, and disease. Whether one cause of death was chemical warfare in the form of toxic yellow rain has been the subject of abundant controversy, a debate that has diverted attention from the Holocaust that the Hmong incontestably suffered from conventional weapons. Although they suffered far worse losses per capita than the South Vietnamese, whose agonies were featured daily in the American press, the Hmong were almost completely overlooked, partly because all reporters were barred from Long Tien. On one occasion when an American, British, and French journalist did manage to sneak into Long Tien, Vang Pao was so worried about having his secret base exposed that he decided to blow up their jeep and was dissuaded only with great difficulty by his CIA advisors. When the Hmong were mentioned, the crucial element of American involvement was usually missing from the account, either because the reporter couldn't confirm it or because the information was embargoed. In northern Laos, 90% of the villages were affected by the war. That is to say, the inhabitants suffered casualties or were displaced or both. Entire villages fled en masse after their houses were burned and their headmen beaten or killed during nighttime raids by the Pathet Lao or North Vietnamese. Some villages decamped to avoid incidental bombing by American or Royal Lao aircraft. In 1971, a Hmong leader in Long Pot, a village 30 miles northwest of Long Tien, was asked which he feared most, attacks by the enemy Pathet Lao or bombs dropped by his own allies. "The bombs," he replied. "The bombs!" Some were evacuated by Air America on the theory that in areas where the Pathet Lao were inevitably advancing, the communists' military gains would be diminished if they captured only land and not people. Some villages simply collapsed because all the able-bodied men were dead or fighting, and the remaining women, children, and elderly men were unable to work enough fields to feed themselves. By 1970, forced to adapt their migratory habits to wartime, more than a third of the Hmong in Laos had become refugees within their own country. Yang Dao, a Hmong scholar and government advisor, wrote at the time, "In Hua Pan and Sinh Quang provinces, the war has reached into every home and forced every individual, down to the very youngest, to make the agonizing choice of flight or death. Displaced people have taken refuge in temporary settlements to the south, where there is little to eat, where schools are non-existent, where sanitary conditions are deplorable, and where hopelessness and despair are constant companions. During these troubled times, total disorder prevailed. What government there was intervened only to attend to the most pressing situations. The heat and the rains, compounded by the lack of hygiene among people accustomed to living in relative isolation, quickly led to the spread of disease and epidemics ravaging the teeming refugee population, particularly the children. In the space of only a few years, the southwest part of the Plain of Jars, once a lush green forest where tigers roamed, has been urbanized under the pressure of a continuing exodus that has no relationship whatsoever to the normal sort of economic development linked to industrialization. Today, more than 200,000 people live in settlements and military bases ranging from 500 to 30,000 inhabitants, confined to a mountainous strip only 50 by 90 kilometers in area. The rest of the province is total desolation. In some spheres, The Hmong reacted to these upheavals as they had to calamities throughout their history, by grasping their traditional culture even more tightly. Yang Dao reported that displaced families who had lost their livestock continued to go through the motions of